Osho, Gigyan Bhairav Tantra, Volume 1, The Book of the Secrets, A New Commentary, Discourse Number 19, given in Bombay, India.
For Tantra, man himself is the disease. Not that your mind is disturbed, rather your mind is the disturbance. Not that you are tense within, but rather you are the tension. Understand the distinction clearly. If mind is ill, then that illness can be treated. But if mind itself is the illness, then this illness cannot be treated. It can be transcended, but it cannot be treated. That makes the basic difference between Western psychology and Eastern Tantra and the Yoga psychology. That's the difference between Eastern Tantra Yoga and Western psychology. Western psychology thinks that mind can be healthy. Mind as it is can be treated and helped. Because for Western thinking, there is no transcendence, because there is nothing beyond mind. Transcendence is possible only if there is something beyond. So you can leave your present state and move further. But if there is no beyond and mind is the end, then transcendence is impossible. If you think yourself just a body, then you cannot transcend your body. Because who will transcend? And where you will transcend? If you are simply the body, then you cannot go beyond body. If you can go beyond body, that means you are not simply the body, but something plus. That plus becomes the dimension to move beyond. Similarly, if you are just the mind and nothing else, then no transcendence is possible. Then, we can treat individual diseases. Someone is mentally ill. We can treat the illness. We will not touch the mind. We will treat the illness and make the mind normal. And no one will think about whether the normal mind itself is healthy or not. Normal mind is just a statistical mind. Freud says we can bring only any diseased mind to normalcy, as everyone is. But whether everyone is healthy or not, that question cannot be raised. We take it for granted that the collective mind, average mind, is okay. So whenever someone goes beyond that average mind, moves somewhere else, he has to be brought back and readjusted. So the whole Western psychology has been an effort of readjustment. Readjustment to the ordinary mind, average mind. In this sense, there are thinkers, particularly one very intelligent thinker, Joffe. He says, genius is a disease. Because genius is abnormal. If normalcy is health, then genius is disease. He is not normal. He is in a certain way mad. His madness may be useful, so we may allow him to live an Einstein or a Van Gogh or Isaac, poets, painters, scientists, mystics. They are mad. But their madness can be allowed for two reasons. Either their madness is just harmless, or their madness is utilitarian. Through their madness, they contribute something which a normal mind cannot contribute. Because they are mad, so they have moved to one extreme. And they can see certain things normal mind cannot see. So we can allow these madmen, even we can make them Nobel laureates, but they are ill. If normalcy is the criterion and the standard of health, then everyone who is not normal is ill. And Joffe suggests that a day will come when we will treat scientists, poets, in the same way we treat madmen. We will make them readjust to the average mind. This attitude is because of a particular hypothesis that mind is the end, there is no beyond. Just opposite this to this attitude is the Eastern approach. We here say that mind itself is the disease. So whether normal or abnormal, we will make only this distinction, normally ill and abnormally ill. A normal man is normally ill. He is not so much ill that you can detect. He is just average. Because everyone else is like him, he cannot be detected. Even the person, the psychoanalyst who treats him, is himself a normally ill person. Mind itself is the disease for us. Why? Why can't mind itself disease? we will have to approach it from a different dimension, then it will be easy. For us, body is death. For the Eastern penetration, body is the death. So you cannot create a perfectly healthy body, otherwise it will not die. You can create a certain balance, but body as such, because it is going to die, is prone to be ill. So health can only be a relative thing. Body cannot be perfectly healthy, cannot be. That's why medical science has no standard and no definition of what health is. They can define diseases, they can define a particular disease, but they cannot define what health is. Or at most negatively, that when a person is not ill, particularly ill, he is healthy. But to define health in a negative way looks absurd. Then disease becomes the primary thing by which you define health. But health cannot be defined, because really body can never be really healthy. Every moment body is in a relative balance only, because death is progressing with life. You are dying also. You are not simply alive. You are dying simultaneously. Death and life are not two ends far away from each other. They are like two legs simultaneously walking. And they both belong to you. This very moment you are alive and dying, both. Something is dying within you, every moment, within 70 years span. The death will reach to the goal. Every moment you will go on dying and dying and dying, and then you will die. The day you are born, you have started dying. The birthday is also the death day. If you are dying continuously, and death is not something which will come from without, but something which will grow within, then the body can never be really healthy. How it can be? When it is dying every moment, how it can be really healthy? It can be relatively healthy. So if you are normally healthy, it is enough. The same is with the mind. Mind cannot be really healthy, whole, because the very existence of the mind is such that it is bound to remain diseased, ill at ease, tense, anxious, in anxiety. The very nature of the mind is such. So we will have to understand what is this nature. Three things. One, mind is a link between body and the no body which is within you. It is a link between the material and the non-material within you. It is one of the most mysterious bridges. It bridges two quite contradictory things, matter and spirit. If you can conceive the paradox, you make a bridge over a river, but both the banks are material. In this case, mind is the bridge between one bank, which is material, and another, which is non-material. between the visible and the invisible, between the dying and the non-dying, between life and death, between body and spirit, whatsoever you name these two banks. Because mind bridges such contradiction, it is bound to remain tense. It cannot be at ease. It is always moving from the visible to the invisible, from the invisible to the visible. Every moment, mind is in deep tension. It has to bridge two things which cannot be bridged. That's the tension. That's the anxiety. You are every moment in anxiety. I'm not talking about your financial anxieties or other anxieties. They are boundary anxieties, fringe anxieties. The real anxiety is not that. A real anxiety is that of a Buddha. You are also in that anxiety. But you are so much burdened by your day-to-day anxieties, you cannot find out your basic anxiety. Once you find out your basic anxiety, you will become religious. Religion is a concern for the basic anxiety. Buddha became anxious in a different way. He was not worried about finance. He was not worried about a beautiful wife. He was not worried about anything. There was no worry. Ordinary worries were not there. He was secure, safe, son of a great king, husband of a very beautiful wife, and everything available. The moment he will desire anything and he will get it. All that was possible for him. Suddenly he became anxiety ridden. And that anxiety was a basic anxiety, primary anxiety. He saw a man dead being carried away, and he asked his chariot driver, "What has happened to this man?" And the driver said, "This man is dead now, he has died." That was the first encounter with death. So Buddha asked immediately, "Is everyone prone to death? Am I also going to die?" Look at the question. You may not have asked it. You may have asked who has died, why he has died. He looks young. This is not the age to die. Those anxieties are not basic. They are not concerned with you. You may have felt sympathetic. You may have felt sad, but still, that is just on the circumference, and you will have forgotten within a few moments. Buddha turned the whole question towards himself here, and he asked, "Am I going to die?" The chariot driver said, "I cannot lie to you. Everyone is prone to death. Everyone is to die." Buddha said, "Then turn back the chariot. If I am going to die, then what is the use of life? You have created deep anxiety in me. Now, unless this anxiety is resolved, I cannot be at ease." What anxiety? A basic anxiety. So if you become basically aware of the very situation of life, of body, of mind, a subtle anxiety will creep in. And then that anxiety will continue to tremble within you. Whatsoever you are doing, our not doing, the anxiety will be there, a deep anguish. Mind is bridging an abyss, impossible abyss. Body is to die. And you have something X within you, which is deathless. These are two contradictions. As if you are standing on two boats, which are moving in opposite directions, then you will be in a deep conflict. That conflict is the conflict of the mind. Mind is between two opposites. One. Secondly, mind is a process, not a thing. Mind is not a thing, it is a process. The word mind gives a false notion. When we say mind, it appears as if there is something like mind within you. There is nothing. Mind is not a thing. Mind is a process, so it is better to call it minding, not mind. We have a word chitta in Sanskrit, which means minding. Not mind, minding, a process. A process can never be silent. A process will always be tense. A process means a turmoil. And mind is always moving from the past to the future. The past goes on being burdened on it, and it has to move into the future. This constant movement creates another tension within you. If you become too much conscious about it, you may go mad. So, that's why we are always engaged in something or other. We don't want to be unoccupied. If you are unoccupied, then you will become conscious of the inner process, of the minding. And that will give you very much a strange, peculiar tension. So everyone wants to be occupied somewhere or other. One goes on reading the same newspaper again and again. If nothing is to be there to do, one goes on reading the same newspaper again. Why? Can't you sit silent? It is difficult, because if you sit silent, you become aware of the totally tense process within. So everyone is in search of escapes. Alcohol can give that, you become unconscious. Sex can give that, for a moment you forget yourself completely. Television can give that, music can give that. Wherever you can forget yourself and become occupied so much that for a time being, you are as if you are not. This constant escaping from oneself is really because of this process of minding. If you are unoccupied, and unoccupiedness means meditation, if you are totally unoccupied, you will become aware of your inner processes. And mind is the basic process within. That's why so many people come to me and they say, we have come to meditate. But when we start meditating, we become more tense. We were not so tense before, and we were not so much worried before. And ordinarily, the whole day we are not so much worried, but when we sit down quietly and start meditating, thoughts rush upon us. They crouch, and that is something new. So they think it is because of meditation that thoughts are crowding them. It is not because of meditation. Thoughts are crowding you every moment of your existence. But you are so occupied without, you cannot be conscious of it. So whenever you sit down, you become conscious. You become conscious of something you have been escaping constantly. Minding is a process, and a process is an effort. Energy is wasted in it, dissipated in it. It is necessary. For life, it is needed. It is part of the struggle of survival. It is a weapon, and one of the most violent weapons. That's why man could survive other animals. They are more strong physically, but they lack a subtle weapon, minding. They have dangerous teeth, dangerous nails, more powerful than man. They can kill man completely, instantly, but they lack one weapon, minding. Because of that subtle weapon, man could kill, survive. So it is a survival measure. It is needed, it is necessary. And it is violent. Mind is violent. It is part of a long violence man has to pass through. It has been built through violence. So whenever you will sit down, you will feel inner violence. Thoughts rushing. Violent thoughts. A turmoil. As if you are going to explode. That's why no one wants to sit silently. Everyone comes and asks, give me some support, some inner support. I cannot just sit silently. Give me a name so I can repeat. Ram, Ram, Ram. Give me a name so I can repeat. Then I can be silent. Really, what you are doing, you are creating a new occupation. Then you can be silent because mind is still occupied. Now you are focused on Ram, 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 chanting. Mind is still not unoccupied. Mind as a process is bound to be always ill. It cannot be so balanced as silence needs it. Thirdly, mind is created from without. You just have the capacity. When you are born, you have just the capacity for mind, but no mind. Just a possibility, a potentiality. So if a child is brought up without society, without a society, the child will grow. He will have a body, but not a mind. He will not be able to speak any language. He will not be able to think in concepts. He will be like any animal. Society trains your capacity into actuality. It gives you a mind. That's why a Hindu has a different mind and a Mohammedan has a different mind. They both are men, but their minds are different. A Christian has a different mind. These minds are different because different societies have cultivated them with different purposes, different goals. A boy, a child is born, a girl is born. They don't have minds. They have only the possibility. The mind can sprout. It can be there, but it is not there. It's just a seed. Then you train them. Then a boy becomes a different mind and a girl becomes a different mind because you teach differently. Then a Hindu becomes different and a Mohammedan becomes different. Then a theist is different and an atheist is different. These minds are being brought up in you, they are conditioned. Forced upon you. Because of this, mind as such is always old and orthodox. There can be no progressive mind. The statement may look strange. There can be no progressive mind. Mind is orthodox because it is a conditioning. So the so-called progressives are as much orthodox about their progressiveness as any orthodox. Look at a communist. He thinks he is very progressive. But Marx, Das Kapital is just as authoritative upon him as any Quran on any Mohammedan or any Gita on any Hindu. And if you start criticizing Marx, he feels as much hurt as any Jaina will feel if you start criticizing Mahavir. Mind is orthodox because it is conditioned by the past, by the society, by others, for certain purposes. Why? I'm making you aware of this fact. Because life changes every moment. And mind belongs to the past. Mind is always old and life is always new. There is bound to be tension and conflict. You fall in love with a woman. A new situation. And you have a Hindu mind and the woman is Mohammedan. Now there will be conflict. Now there is going to be much anguish, unnecessary. But the woman is Mohammedan. And life has brought you to a situation where you fell in love with her. Now life gives you a new phenomena and mind has nothing to how to deal with it. There is no know-how. There will be conflict. That's why in a very changing world, people become uprooted. Their lives become anxious. This was not so in past ages. Man was more silent, not really, appeared more silent. Because the state of affairs around him was so static. Mind was not much in conflict. Now everything is changing so fast and the mind cannot change so fast. Mind clings to the past and everything changes every moment. That's why so much anxiety in the West. In the East there is less anxiety. This is strange because East has to face more basic problems. Food is not there. Clothes are not there. Houses are not there. Everyone is just starved. But they are less in anxiety. And West is in more anxiety. Affluent, scientifically developed, technologically on a higher state of living. But why so much anxiety? Because technology gives life such fast change that the mind cannot cope with it. Before you are adjusted to a new thing, the new has become old and has changed. Again, the gap. Life is forcing new situations, and mind always tries to react with old conditioning. That gap that goes on growing, and more the gap will be there, the more anxiety. Mind is orthodox and life is not orthodox. These are three reasons why mind is the disease. What to do? If you are to treat the mind, there are easy ways. Psychoanalysis is easy. It may take a long time. It may not succeed, but still it is not difficult. But this transcendence of the mind is difficult, arduous. Because you have to leave the mind completely. You have to take wing and go beyond. And leave the mind as it is. Don't touch it. Look at, for example, I am here and the room is hot. So I can do two things. I can air condition the room. But I live in the room. I go on making arrangements so the room is not hot. But then every arrangement has to be looked after. And then every arrangement creates its own anxieties and problems. There is another possibility. I leave the room and go out. This is the difference. West goes on living in the same room of the mind, trying to adjust, to make arrangements, so that living in the mind becomes at least normal. It may not be very blissful, but it becomes less and less unhappy. It may not reach a point, a peak of happiness, but one is saved from much suffering, less and less suffering. Freud has said that there is no possibility that man can be happy. At the most, if you can arrange your mind in such a way that you are normal, you will be less unhappy than others. That's all. This is very hopeless. But Freud is a very genuine, authentic thinker. And his insight is right in a way, because he cannot see beyond the mind. That's why East has not developed really any psychology compared to Freud, Jung, or Adler. And that is strange. Because East has been talking about mind for 5,000 years, at least. 5,000 years of talking about mind, meditation, going beyond. Why couldn't East create psychologies? Psychology is a very recent development in the West. Why couldn't East create a psychology? Buddha was here, who talks about deepest layers of the mind. He talks about the conscious, he talks about the subconscious, he talks about the unconscious. He must have known. But why we couldn't develop psychologies about conscious, unconscious, subconscious? The reason is this: East has not been interested in the room. It talks about the room a little just to go beyond, just to go out. We have been interested in the room just to find out the door. That's all. We are not interested in details about the room. We are not going to live in it. So the only interest had been this: how to go out. Where is the door? We have talked about the room only for this, so that the door can be located. How to open it and go out. This has been our whole interest. That's why no psychology could be developed in India. If you are not interested in this room, you will not make maps about the room. You will not measure every wall and every inch of space. You are not bothered about these things. You are only interested, where is the door? Or where is the window? So I can jump out. And the moment you are out, you will forget the room completely. Because then you are under a great sky infinite. You will not remember even that there was a room and you lived in a cave, while all the time the infinite sky was beyond and you could have moved any moment. You will forget the room completely. If you can go beyond the mind, what happens? The mind remains the same. You don't make any change in the mind. But you go beyond it and everything changes. Then you can come back to the room again if you need. But you will be a different man. This going out and coming in has made you qualitatively different. A man who has been living in a room and has not known without is a different man. He is not really a man. He lives like a beetle. He lives like an insect. He moves out. The sky, open sky, and the sun, and the clouds, and the infinite expanse. He becomes different immediately. This impact of the infinite makes him, for the first time, man, consciousness. Now he can move again into the room, but he will be a different man. Now the room can only be something which can be used. But it is not now a prison. He can move out any moment. Then the room becomes just something to be used, utilitarian. Previously he was imprisoned in it. Now he is not imprisoned. He is a master. And he knows there is the sky outside and the infinite is waiting him. And even this room is part of that infinite now. And even this small, limited sky and space within the room is the space, the same space which is outside. The man comes in again and lives in the room, uses the room, but now he is not imprisoned in it. This is a qualitative change. East is concerned how to go beyond mind and then use it. Don't be identified with the mind, that's the message. And all the techniques of meditation are concerned only about how to find out the door, how to use the key, how to unlock it and go out. Two matters we will discuss today. they are concerned with stopping in the middle of the activity. We discussed three before, now the remaining two. Fourth message. Suppose you are gradually being deprived of strength or of knowledge. At the instant of deprivation, transcend. You can do it in an actual situation, or you can imagine the situation. For example, lie down. Relax. And feel as if your body is going to die. Close your eyes. Start feeling you are dying. Soon you will feel your body is becoming heavy. If the feeling is authentic that I'm dying, imagine. The body will start becoming heavy. You will feel your body has become as if of lead. You want to move your hand, but you cannot move. It has become so heavy and dead. Go on feeling that you are dying. And when you feel now a moment has come, and just a jump and you will be dead. Then suddenly forget your body and transcend. Suppose you are gradually being deprived of strength or of knowledge, at the instant of deprivation, transcend. When you feel that the body is dead, what is meant by transcending now? Look at the body. Up to now you were feeling you are dying. Now the body has become a dead weight. Look at the body, forget that you are dying, now be the observer. That the body is lying dead and you are looking at it. There will be a transcendence. You will be out of your mind. Because the dead body needs no mind. A dead body relaxes so much that the very process of the mind stops. But you are there and the body is there. The mind is absent. Remember, mind is needed for life, not for death. If suddenly you come to know that within an hour you will die, what you will do in that hour, 1 hour left, and it is certain that you are going to die after 1 hour, exactly after 1 hour, what you will do? Your thinking will drop completely, because the whole thinking is concerned either with the past or with the future. You were planning to purchase a house or to purchase a car, or you were planning to marry someone or divorce someone. You were thinking many things and they were constantly on your mind. Now, 1 hour more. No meaning in marriage and no meaning in divorce. Now you can leave all the planning to others who are going to live. With life, planning ceases. With life, worrying ceases. Because every worry is life-oriented. You have to live tomorrow, that's why there is worry. So all those who have been teaching meditation to the world, they have been always saying, don't think of the morrow. Jesus says to his disciples, don't think of the morrow. Because if you think of the morrow, you cannot go into meditation. Then you move into worries. But we are so fond of worries that not only we think of the morrow, we think of the other life. So we plan not only for this life, we plan for the other life also, beyond death. One day I was passing through a street and someone gave me a pamphlet. A very beautiful house was painted on the cover. and a beautiful garden, lovely, divinely lovely, and very big capital letters, a question: do you want such a beautiful house and such a beautiful garden? And without any price, without any cost. Free of cost. I turned it over. It was not of this earth. It was a Christian pamphlet. If you want such a beautiful house and such a beautiful garden, believe in Jesus. Those who believe in him, they will get in the kingdom of God such houses free of cost. Mind goes on, not only thinking of the morrow, but thinking beyond death and arranging. Making reservations for the afterlife. Such a mind cannot be a religious mind. A religious mind cannot think of the morrow. So those who think of the afterlife are constantly worried about it. Whether God will behave rightly with them or not. Churchill was dying, and someone asked him, "Are you ready to meet the Father there in the heaven?" Churchill said, "That is not my worry. I am constantly worried whether the Divine Father is ready to meet me." But either way, one goes on worrying about future. Buddha said, there is no heaven and no afterlife. He said, there is no soul and your death will be total and complete. Nothing will survive. People thought he is an atheist. He was not. He was just trying to create a situation in which you can forget the morrow and can remain in this very moment here and now. Then meditation follows very easily. So if you are thinking of death, not death which will come, allow it to come here. Fall down on the ground, lie dead. Relax and feel, I am dying, I am dying, I am dying. And not only think, feel in every limb of the body, in every fiber of the body, let death creep in. It is one of the most beautiful meditations. Then suddenly when you feel the body is dead weight, you cannot move your hand, you cannot move your head, everything has become dead. Suddenly look at your own body. Mind will not be there. You can look, you will be there, consciousness will be there. Look at your body. It will not look yours. It will be just a body. The gap between you and the body will be clear, crystal clear. There will be no bridge. Body is lying dead and you are there, standing as a witness, not in it. Not in it. Remember, the feeling that I am in the body is because of the mind. This feeling that I am in the body is because of the mind. If the mind is not there, absent, you will not say I am in the body or out of the body. You will be simply there. No in and out. in and out are both relative terms associated with the mind. Simply, you will be there witnessing. This is transcendence. You can do it in many ways. Sometimes in actual situations, you are ill and you are feeling that there is no hope, you are going to die. A very useful situation. Use it for meditation. You can try it in other ways also. Suppose you are gradually being deprived of strength, lie down and feel that as if the whole existence is sucking your strength out. You are being sucked from everywhere. Your strength is being sucked. Soon you will be impotent, completely devoid of strength. The energy is flowing out, being taken out. Soon nothing will be left inside. That is how life is. You are being sucked out. Everything that is around you is sucking you out. One day, you will be just a dead cell. Everything has been sucked out, the life has flown out of you, and the dead body remains there. Imagine this very moment you can do it. Lie down and feel the energy is being sucked out. Within few days you will have the knack how energy goes out. And when you feel everything has moved out, nothing has now left within you, transcend. At the instant of deprivation, transcend. When the last quantum of energy is leaving you, transcend. Be an onlooker. Just become a witness. Then this universe and this body both are not you. You are looking at the phenomena. This transcendence will bring you out of the mind. This is the key. And whatsoever is your liking, you can do it in many ways. For example, we were talking about run around, exhaust yourself, and go on running and running and running. Don't stop by yourself. Let the body fall. When every fiber is exhausted, you will fall down. When you are falling down, become aware. Just look that the body is falling down. And sometimes a very miraculous happening happens. You remain standing and the body has fallen down. And you can look at it. You can look at it, the body has fallen down and you are still standing. Don't fall with the body. Roam around, run, dance, exhaust the body. But remember, you are not to lie down. Then the inner consciousness moves with the body and lies down. You are not to lie down. You just go on doing it until the body falls by itself. Then it falls like a dead weight. Immediately when the body, you feel the body is falling, and you cannot do anything, open your eyes, be alert, don't miss the point. Be alert and see what is happening. You may be still standing and the body has fallen down. And once known, you can never forget it, that you are different from the body. This standing out really is the meaning of the English word ecstasy. Ecstasy means to stand out. And once you can feel you are out of the body, there is no mind in that moment, because mind is the bridge that gives you the feeling that you are in the body. If you are out of the body for a single moment, there will be no mind in that moment. This is transcendence. Then move in the body, then move in the mind, but you cannot forget the experience now. That experience has become part and parcel of your being. It will be there always. And go on doing it every day. And many things happen through such a simple process. The West is always worried how to tackle mind. And it tries to find out many ways, but still nothing works or seems to work. Everything becomes a fashion and then dies. Now, psychoanalysis is a dead movement. New movements are there. Encounter groups, group psychology, action psychology, and many things. But just like a fashion, they come and go. Why? Because within mind, you can make at the most only arrangements. They will be disturbed again and again. To make arrangements with the mind is making a house on sand, or making a house of playing cards. It is always wavering, and the fear is always there. Now it is going to any moment, it will not be there. Going beyond the mind is the only way to be inwardly happy and healthy, to be whole. Then move in the mind and use the mind, but then mind becomes the instrument and you are not identified with it. So two things. Either you are identified with the mind, this is illness for Tantra. You are not identified with the mind, you use it as an instrument, then you are healthy and whole. Fifth technique, very simple in one sense and the most difficult in another, and only of two words. The fifth technique says, devotion frees. Just two words, devotion frees. Simply one word, really, because frees is the consequence. Devotion. What is meant by devotion? In Vigyan Bhairav Tantra, there are two types of techniques. One for those who are intellectually oriented, scientifically oriented, and others for those who are heart oriented, emotion oriented, poetically oriented. And there are only two types of mind, the scientific mind and the poetic mind. And these are poles apart. They nowhere meet, and they cannot meet. Sometimes they run parallel, but still, no meeting. And sometimes it happens in a single individual that he is a poet and a scientist. Rarely, but sometimes it happens that he is both a poet and a scientist. Then he has a split personality. He is really two persons, not one. And when he is a poet, he forgets the scientist completely. Otherwise, the scientist will be disturbing. And when he is a scientist, he has to forget the poet completely and move into another world with another arrangement of concepts, ideas, logic, reason, mathematics. When he moves to the world of poetry, the mathematics is no more there. Music is there. Concepts are no more there. Words are there, but liquid, not solid. And one word flows into the another. And one word can mean many things, or may not mean anything. The grammar is lost, only the rhythm retained. A different world. Thinking and feeling, these are the two types, basic types. The first technique I taught was for a scientific mind. The second technique, devotion freeze, is for a feeling type. And remember, to find out your type and no type is higher or lower. Don't think that the intellectual type is higher or the feeling type is higher. No. They are simply types. No one is higher or lower. So just think factually, what is your type? This second technique is for the feeling type. Why? Because devotion is towards something else. And devotion is a blind thing. In devotion, the other becomes more important than you. It is a trust. The intellectual cannot trust anybody. He can only criticize. He cannot trust. He can doubt. He cannot have faith. And if sometimes some intellectual comes to faith, it is never authentic. First, he tries to convince himself about his faith. He finds out proofs, arguments, and when he is satisfied that the arguments help, the proofs help, then he believes. But he has missed the point. Because faith is not argumentative, and faith is not based on proofs. Because if proofs are there, then there is no need of faith. You don't believe in the sun, you don't believe in the sky, you know. Or do you believe sun rising? If someone asks, what is your belief about the sun rising? You say, I believe in it. I am a great believer. You said the sun is rising and I know it. No question of belief or disbelief. Is there someone who disbelieves in the sun? There is no one. Faith means a jump into the unknown without any proofs. Difficult. Difficult for the intellectual type, because the whole thing becomes absurd, foolish. First proofs must be there. If you say there is a God and surrender yourself to the God, first, the God has to be proved, but then God becomes a theorem. Of course, proved, but useless. God must remain unproved, otherwise it is of no use, because then faith is meaningless. If you believe in a proved God, then your God is just a theorem of geometry. No one believes in theorems of Euclid. There is no need, they can be proved. That which can be proved cannot be made the base of faith. One of the most mysterious Christian saints, Tertullian, he has said, I believe in God because he is absurd. That's right. That is the attitude of the feeling type. He says, because he cannot be proved. That's why I believe in him. The statement is illogical, irrational. Because logical statement must be like this. These are the proofs of God. Therefore, I believe in him. And he says, because there are no proofs and no arguments can prove that God is, therefore, I believe in him. And he is right in a way, because faith means a jump into the unknown without any reasons. Only a feeling type can do that. Forget devotion, first understand love. Then you will be able to understand devotion. You fall in love. Why we say falling in love? Nothing falls, just your head. What falls in love? But your head. You fall down from the head. That's why we say falling in love. Because the language is created by intellect types. For them, love is a lunacy. Love is madness. One has fallen in love, it means now you can expect anything. Now he is mad. Now no reasoning will help. You cannot reason with him. Can you reason with someone who is in love? People try. People try, but nothing proves. You have fallen with someone in love. Everyone says that that one is not worth. Or you are entering dangerous terrain. You are proving yourself foolish. You can find a better partner, but nothing will help. No reason will help. You are in love. Now reason is useless. Love has its own reasoning. We say falling in love means now your behavior will be irrational. Look at two lovers. Their behavior, their communication, it becomes irrational. They start using baby talk. Why? Even a great scientist, when he falls in love, he will use baby language. Why not use a highly developed technological language? Why use this baby talk? But that highly technologized language is of no use. One of my friends married a girl. The girl was Czech. She did knew a little of English. And this man, he knew a little of Czech. They got married. He was a highly educated man, a professor in university, and the girl was also a professor. But the man said to me, I was staying with him, he said to me, it is very difficult because I know only technological Czech, the technological terminology. And she also knows technological English. But we cannot have baby talk. So it is strange. Our love is just, we feel that somewhere on this surface, we cannot move deep. The language becomes the barrier. I can talk as a professor. As far as my subject is concerned, I can talk about it. And she can talk about her subject. And love has been no one's subject. So, why you fall in baby talk, because that was your first love experience with your mother. Those words that you uttered first were love words. They were not head oriented. They came from the heart. They belong to the feeling. They have a different quality. So even when you have a very developed language, when you love again, you fall back. You fall back to the baby talk. Those words are different. They don't belong to this category of mind. They belong to the heart. They may not be so expressive, so meaningful, still they are more expressive and more meaningful. But their meaning is of a different dimension altogether. And if you are very much deep in love, you will fall silent. You cannot talk with your beloved. Or you can talk just by the way, but really there is no talk. If the love goes deep, words become useless. You remain silent. If you cannot remain silent with your beloved, know well, there is no love. Because it is very difficult to live in silence with someone you are not in love. With a stranger, you start immediately talking. Where you are going in a train or in a bus, you start immediately talking, because to sit by the side of a stranger silently is very difficult, awkward. Because there is no other gap unless you create a language bridge. There is no bridge. No inner bridge is possible with an stranger. You are closed in yourself and he is closed in himself, and two enclosures just side by side. Every fear of colliding and danger. You create a bridge. You start talking about the weather or about anything. Anything nonsense. And that gives a feeling that you are bridged. You are communicating. Two lovers will fall silent. And when two lovers start talking again, you can know well the love has disappeared. They have become strangers. So go and look. Wives and husbands, whenever they are alone, they will talk anything. And they both know. They both are aware that there is no need to talk, but it is so difficult to remain silent. So anything, any trivia will do, but talk, so that you can have the feeling that communication is there. But two lovers will fall silent. Language will disappear, because language belongs to the reason. First it will become a baby talk and then disappear. Then there will be silent in communication. What is their communication? It is irrational. They feel attuned to a different dimension of existence. And they feel happy in that attunement. And if you ask them to prove what is their happiness, they cannot prove it. No lover has been able to prove up to now that why he is happy in love. Why? Because love implies much suffering. Still, lovers are happy. Love has a deep suffering. Because when you become one with someone, it is always difficult. Two minds becoming one. It is not only of two bodies becoming one. That is the difference between sex and love. If only two bodies are becoming one, it is not very difficult and there is no suffering. It is one of the easiest things any animal can do. Easiest. But when two people are in love, very difficult. Because two minds have to dissolve. Two minds have to be absent. Only then the space is created between a love can flower. No one reasons about love. No one can prove that love gives happiness. No one can even prove that love exists. And there are scientists, behaviorists, followers of Watson and Skinner. They say, just illusion. There is no love. You are just an illusion. You feel that you are in love, but there is no love. You just dream. And no one can prove them wrong. They say that love is just a hallucination, a psychedelic experience, nothing real, just body chemistry influencing you, just body hormones, chemicals influencing your behavior and giving a false world to you. No one can prove them wrong. But the miracle is this, that even a Watson will fall in love. Even a Watson will fall in love, knowing well that this is just a chemical affair. And even a Watson will be happy. But it cannot be proved. It is so inner and subjective. What happens in love, the other becomes important, more important than you. You become the periphery and he becomes the center. Logic always remains self-centered. Mind always remains ego-centered. I am the center and everything just encircles around me, for me. But I am the center. This is how reason works. If you move with reason too much, you will come to the conclusion Berkeley came. He said, only I exist and everything else just an idea in my mind. How can I prove that you are there, sitting here just before me? How can I prove reasonably, rationally, that you are there? Really, you may be just a dream. I may be just dreaming and talking. You may not be there at all. How can I prove to myself that really you are there? I can of course touch you, but I can touch you even in a dream. And even in a dream I feel when I touch someone. I can hit you and you will scream, but even in a dream if I hit someone, the dream figure screams. So how can I make a distinction that my idence here just now is not a dream but a reality? It may be just a fiction. Go to any madhouse and you will find people sitting alone talking. To whom they are talking? I may be talking to no one. How can I prove rationally that you are there really? So if reason goes to the extreme, to the very logical extreme, then only I remain. And everything becomes a dream. This is how reason works. Quite the contrary is the path of heart. I become illusory and you, thou, the other, the beloved, becomes the real. If you move to the very extreme, then it becomes devotion. If your love comes to such an extreme point that you forget yourself completely that you are, and you have no notion of yourself, only the other remains. That's devotion. A love can become devotion. Love is the first step only then devotion can flourish. But for us, even love is a far away reality. Only sex is the real. Love has two possibilities. Either it falls into sex and becomes a body thing, or it rises into devotion and becomes a spirit thing. Love is just in between. Just below it is the abyss of sex, and beyond it is the open sky, infinite sky of devotion. If love grows deeper and the other becomes more and more significant, so significant that you begin to call the other your God. That's why Meera goes on calling Krishna God. No one can see Krishna. And Meera cannot prove that the Krishna is there. But she is not interested in proving at all. She has made that point, Krishna, her love object. And remember, whether it is a real person you make love object, or just your imagination, it makes no difference. The whole transformation comes through devotion, not through the beloved. Remember this. Krishna may not be there at all. It is irrelevant. For the lover, it is irrelevant. For Radha, Krishna was there in reality. For Meera, Krishna was not there in reality. That's why Meera is a greater devotee than Radha. And even Radha will become jealous of Meera. Because for Radha, the real person was there. It is not so difficult to feel Krishna's reality when he is present. But when Krishna is no more there, Meera alone living in her room and talking to the Krishna and living for him, who is nowhere. For her, he is everything and all. She cannot prove. Irrational. But she has taken a jump. And she became transformed. Devotion freed her. I want to emphasize the fact that it is not a question whether Krishna is there or not. It is not. This feeling that Krishna is there, this total feeling of love, this total surrender, this losing oneself into him, who may be or may not be, this losing itself is the transformation. Suddenly one is purified, totally purified, because when the ego is not there, you cannot be impure in any way. Because ego is the seed of all impurity. The feeling of ego is the root of all madness for the feeling world, for the world of the devotee. Ego is the disease. Ego dissolves, and it dissolves in only one way, and there is no other way. Only one way. The other becomes so important, so significant, that by and by you pale down, disappear. One day you are no more. Just a consciousness remains of the other. And when you are no more, the other is also not the other. Because it is other only when you are there. When the I disappears, the thou also disappears. In love, you take the first step. The other becomes important. You remain. For certain moments, there may be a peak when you are not. And those are rare peaks of love. But ordinarily, you remain and the lover is there. But the lover becomes more important than you. You can die for him or her. If you can die for someone, there is love. The other has become the meaning of your life. And only if you can die for someone, you can live for someone. If you cannot die for someone, you cannot live for someone. Life gets a meaning only through death. In love, the other has become important, but you are still there in some higher peaks of communication. You may disappear and will come again. But this will be for only moments. So lovers have glimpses of devotion. That's why in India, the beloved used to call her lover her god. Only in peaks, the other becomes divine. And the other becomes divine only when you are not. This can grow. And if you make it a sadhana, if you make it an inner search, not just enjoying love, but transforming yourself through love, then it becomes devotion. In devotion, you surrender yourself completely. And this surrender can be to a god who may not be in the sky, or maybe, or to a teacher who may not be awakened, or maybe, or to a beloved who may not be worth, or maybe. That is irrelevant. If you can allow yourself to dissolve for the others, you will be transformed. Devotion frees. That's why we have glimpses of freedom only in love. When you are in love, you have a subtle freedom. This is paradoxical. Because everyone else will see you that you have become a slave. If you are in love with someone, all around you will think that you both have become slaves of each other. But you will have glimpses of freedom. Love is freedom. Why? Because ego is the bondage. There is no other bondage. You may be in a prison and you cannot escape. Your beloved comes into the prison. The prison disappears the very moment. The walls are there still, but they don't imprison you. Now you can forget them completely. You can dissolve into each other, and you can become for each other a sky to fly. The prison has disappeared. It is no more there. And you may be under open sky, totally free, unfettered, without love. You are in a prison because you have nowhere to fly. This sky will not do. Words fly in that sky. You cannot. You need a different sky, the sky of consciousness. Only the other can give you that sky, the first taste of it. When the other opens for you and you move into the other, you can fly. Love is freedom, but not total. Just glimpses. If love becomes devotion, then it becomes total freedom. It means surrendering the self completely. So those who are of feeling type, for them the sutra, devotion varies. A Ramakrishna, if you look at Ramakrishna, you will feel he is just a slave to the goddess Kali, Mother Kali. He cannot do anything without her permission. Just a slave. But no one was more free than him. When he was appointed for the first time priest in Dakshineshwar, the temple, he started behaving strangely. So the committee, the trustees gathered and they said, throw this man out. He is behaving undevotionally. Because first he will smell the flower and then the flower will be put in the feet of the goddess. And that is against ritual. Now, a smell flower cannot be offered to the divine. It has become impure. First he will taste the food which is made for the offering, and then he will offer it. And he was the priest, so the trustees asked him, what you are doing? This cannot be allowed. He said, then I can leave this post. I will move out of the temple. But I cannot offer food to my mother without tasting it. My mother used to taste. Whenever she will prepare something, she will taste first and then only she will give it to me. And I cannot offer a flower without smelling it first. So I can go out. And you cannot check me, you cannot prevent me. I will go on offering anywhere because my mother is everywhere. She is not confined in your temple. So wherever I will be doing the same. It happened that some Mohammedan told him that if your mother is everywhere, then why not come to the mosque? He said, okay, I'm coming. He remained for 6 months. He forgot Dakshineshwar completely. He was in a mosque. Then his friends came, now you can go back. He said, everywhere she is. So one will think that he is a slave. But his devotion is such that now the beloved is everywhere. If you are nowhere, the beloved will be everywhere. If you are somewhere, then the beloved will be nowhere. Enough for today.